Yoder said that he had been an engineer at Lockheed before retiring in the fall of 1968, and that he knew Caesar casually from the plant. Yoder was uncertain of what Caesar's specific job was, saying that he had, quote, floating assignments, and often worked in an off-limits area which only special personnel had access to. This was, said Yoder, the CIA-controlled U-2 spy plane facility. Bear that in mind. We'll get back to that later. Yoder related that about a month after the assassination, Caesar showed him the revolver and he offered to buy it to use in the Ozarks after his retirement. At Yoder's request, Caesar later wrote out a receipt that read, quote, on the day of September 6th, 1968, I received $15 from Jim Yolder, misspelled. The item involved is a H&R pistol, 9-shot, serial number Y13332, signed Thane E. Caesar. Here was documentary evidence that Caesar sold the gun 3 months after the assassination. Yoder remembered that during their post-assassination meeting, Caesar dragged out his security guard uniform, the H&R 22, and his 38 pistol, but didn't mention the RFK assassination. But Caesar, quote, looked a little worried, and he said something about going to the assistance of an officer and firing his gun. He said there might be a little problem over that, unquote. Okay, just real quickly to note a couple of things for you. Again, to make very clear, the investigators assumed that despite the fact that Thane Caesar was the only other person presumed to have drawn a gun, claimed he didn't fire it, happened to have a pistol that just happened to be the same caliber as the one that killed Robert F. Kennedy, that he claimed to at first to have sold it 3 months before the assassination, then suddenly remembered that since he also said that he'd showed it to a police investigator after the assassination, that one of the two couldn't be right. So then he claimed, no, he couldn't have shown it to the investigator because he sold it 3 months before. And then, according to the authors, they talked to the man he sold it to, who produced a bill saying he sold it to him 3 months after the assassination. And last but not least, an interesting fact that Thane Caesar worked at Burbank Lockheed at the in what Yoder said was a special personnel area that was where the CIA worked on the CIA U-2 spy plane. And Dave will explain some of the interesting things about that.
Well, basically, we've looked at a couple of key U-2 connections in past broadcasts. Of course, in the Guns of November, in our very first broadcast in that series, we talked about Lee Harvey Oswald, who had worked at the Atsugi Naval Air Station in Japan, which was one of the main areas from which U-2 flights took off. He also worked at Peshawar in Pakistan at one point, and that also was involved in the U-2 flights. Now, the U-2 plane, as we looked at some information presented by Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, formerly Air Force focal point officer, in other words, involved with coordinating Air Force and CIA activities where CIA requires air units, Fletcher Prouty stated that, in no uncertain terms, that the U-2 spy plane had been deliberately brought down over Russian territory as a provocation. There was no missile available that could have sent this down. And Lee Harvey Oswald basically got the blame in certain circles. The pilot of the U-2, Francis Gary Powers, intimates that Oswald had betrayed this information about the U-2 to the Russians. And incidentally, Oswald had a crypto clearance. And there's a lot of flap in the media now about a bunch of Navy men, Navy cryptologists, who apparently were spying for the Soviets. So this is a problem, I guess, which has bedeviled sections of the military for some time. Of course, Lee Harvey Oswald was actually a U.S. intelligence agent functioning as a double agent in the Soviet Union. This we've looked at in the past.
Well, that's our presumption, we should say.
Well, it looks pretty probable in light of the handling of the man, how he was able to defect to the Russians.
Yes, I agree. It's very probable. But
yeah. We haven't yet... well, there is a report that his CIA number was 110669, which the Warren Commission said was just a rumor, a very specific rumor, but they said it was just a rumor. We'll wait and see what happens. But anyway, back to the U-2. Lee Harvey Oswald gets the blame for something he could not possibly have done. Prouty indicated that not only was the plane sabotaged, but that Francis Gary Powers was, I guess you could say, tagged with identification, which would have made it perfectly obvious to anyone that he was working for CIA. And this was totally in contravention of the accepted procedures in this case. Prouty made it clear that that the Russians did not bring the plane down, that the flight was sabotaged by persons high up within the U.S. intelligence apparatus, and indicated that the flight itself was illegal and that President Eisenhower had forbidden any flights before his summit meeting with Soviet Premier Khrushchev. That summit meeting was deep-sixed by the U-2 incident. Incidentally, a person who was in charge of the security for the U-2 was a fellow by the name of Edwin Wilson, a quote, ex-CIA agent who, along with his cohort Frank Triple, was the subject of our fourth Radio Free America broadcast. And Ed Wilson was, after the being in charge of the U2, did a number of interesting things, which we have interpreted as provocation. He shipped a lot of arms and training personnel to Libya for Muammar Gaddafi. And so the question is, when you have a person whose specialty is provocation, as acting as the basically in charge of security for the U-2, when the U-2 goes down as a provocation, certainly you have to ask yourself some questions. But both Edwin Wilson and Lee Harvey Oswald go back to the U-2. So when we see Eugene Caesar, according to Yoder, working at a top-secret area of the Burbank plant associated with U-2, it certainly raises questions. A lot of different elements and human beings crop up over and over again in connection with all of the assassinations. And later in this broadcast, we're going to take a look at some connecting links between not only the John and Robert Kennedy assassinations, but our other assassinations and attempted assassinations as well. I would also state that we're going to come back next month. Our Radio Free America broadcast is going to be the first of a two-part series, in all probability, about the Aryan Nations, a very powerful neo-Nazi group which has a number of interesting connections. And remember the Lockheed Burbank facility. We're going to come back to that. Continuing now with the account of Turner and Christian here about Thane Eugene Caesar and his transaction with Jim Yoder. Had Yoder ever been interviewed by the LAPD? Yoder said that the Los Angeles police had called him approximately a year earlier, or shortly after Caesar was questioned, and he gave them essentially the same information. He specifically recalled telling the police about the receipt for the gun dated 3 months after the assassination, but he no longer had the gun. Around the time that the police called, his home was burglarized and the gun taken. Once again, the LAPD and DA's office had squelched information that might have pointed to a conspiracy. They knew that Caesar sold the gun after the assassination, not before, as he had contended. They knew that if Caesar had been situated to Kennedy's immediate right and rear, as he himself stated, the entry angle of the three bullets striking Kennedy was consistent with that position. They also must have known that Kennedy apparently clutched Caesar's snap-on bow tie from his neck. In the famous news photo showing the senator lying on his back on the floor, his head in a pool of blood, the shiny black tie appears next to his right hand. Caesar conceded that the tie was his and that he returned to the pantry to retrieve it, but no one ever asked him how it had been ripped from his neck. In early 1976, Allard Lowenstein retrieved a series of assassination broadcast tapes from the Kennedy family and sent them on to West Coast researchers for review. One of those tapes, discovered by Lillian Castellano and Floyd Nelson... By the way, Lillian Castellano was an excellent assassination researcher who was murdered under ambiguous circumstances in Los Angeles immediately following her participation in the Robert Kennedy investigation. Repeating this sentence again. One of those tapes, discovered by Lillian Castellano and Floyd Nelson, involved an interview made by KFWB reporter John Marshall within minutes following the shooting in the kitchen pantry of the Ambassador Hotel. Marshall: I have just talked with an officer who tells me that he was at the senator's side when the shots occurred. Officer, can you confirm that the senator has been shot? Officer: Yes, I was there holding his arm when they shot him. Note the word they shot him. What happened? Answer: I don't know. Gentleman standing by the lunch counter there, and as he walked up, the guy pulled a gun and shot at him. Was it just one man? No. Yeah, one man. Note that he reverses his answer here. Question: What sort of wound did the senator receive? Well, from where I could see, it looked like he was shot in the head and the chest and the shoulder. Okay, now remember earlier Caesar says that he was knocked down and couldn't see what happened. Well, here he just apparently had a very good view, according to him, of what happened. How many shots did you hear? Four. You heard four shots. Did you see anyone else hit at that time? Nope. What is your name, officer? Gene Caesar. In Caesar's 1971 interview by Los Angeles law enforcement officials, he one, denied ever seeing Saran himself, only his gun-wielding hand, and two, stated that he got knocked down and didn't see the actual shooting events after the initial shot was fired. Yet right after the shooting, he tells reporter Marshall details that conflict severely with his later version. It is also curious that Caesar's contemporaneous account locates the exact number and placement of shots and wounds in RFK's body, inflicted from the rear, his own conceded position, when no such identifications were possible until doctors examined the senator at a nearby hospital some 20 minutes later. We find two more of the interview answers equally intriguing. Caesar's reference that they shot him, unquote, and his response, no, yeah, one man, unquote, shot RFK. This same information was available or known to Los Angeles officials from the outset. But instead of focusing on Thane Caesar, District Attorney Joe Bush would swing the beams of his 1971 conspiracy probe onto Bill Harper and John Christian. As indicated there, instead of pursuing Caesar, they pursued the pursuers in an attempt to, obviously, to intimidate them from despoiling the official version of the event. One of the things we're not going to go into here, but there are accounts of other people being in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel, an FBI report. Well, but first, before I tell you about the FBI report, let me tell you, listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills, and the FBI report basically stated that a busboy in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel named Juan Romero testified that two men came to him posing as police officers and that they had Kennedy signs around their neck and that they obtained white kitchen boy's garb the day before Senator Kennedy was killed. There were no policemen sent to the Ambassador Hotel to function in that manner, so the question remains as to just who these people were.
Okay. I'm going to read one last section here, and then we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to play some tape for you. This is a small segment of a published private manuscript by S. Duncan Harp. It's entitled The Tangled Web, An Inquiry into the Assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. And it deals specifically in this small section we're going to read with Thane Caesar, some of his stated political views. It says, we have heretofore presented evidence to show the official explanation of how Sirhan Sirhan shot Senator Robert Kennedy alone and unaided is so critically amiss in so many areas as to be virtually worthless as an account of the events which took place in the kitchen pantry. We have also presented some evidence to show that there may have been more than one gun fired, and that, if so, the probable perpetrator of this action was security guard Caesar. But did Caesar have a motive to kill Robert Kennedy? After all, if he did not have one, he would have been a rather unlikely candidate for an assassin. SUS Chief Houghton stated in his book, Special Unit Senator, that there were no persons of right-wing connections or beliefs in the pantry at the time of the shooting. This statement was incorrect, and if anything, the person who most puts the lie to it was Thane Eugene Caesar. An admitted admirer and 68 campaign worker for George Wallace, Caesar had associations with American Nazis. During Caesar's interviews with Sherrock, who's a man who interviewed him for the purposes of his place in this whole thing, Caesar revealed himself to be both a reactionary and a racist. Caesar told Sherrock, quote, the black man now for the past 4 to 8 years has been cramming this integrated idea down our throat, and so you've learned to hate him. And one of these days, at the rate they're going, there is going to be a civil war in this country. It's going to be white against black, and the only thing I'd say is the black will never win. I mean, me as an individual, I'm fed up, and I know a lot of people that I work with have the same feeling. It's just that we had it shoved down our throat enough. But one of these days, it's going to be shoved too far, and then we're going to fight back. First of all, I think the white man is going to try and do it with his voting power. And if they can't do it by getting the right person to straighten the thing out, then he's going to take it in his own hands. I can't see any other way to go. The blacks, the minorities, have gone too far. One of these days, the white man is going to get tired of, and the minorities aren't going to like what's coming up. We've had it up to here. There's going to be war in this country between black and white, and the blacks ain't never going to win. Said Caesar, quote, you couldn't put in a book what I think of those student protesters. They'd censor it. He further told Sherrock that, quote, he definitely wouldn't have voted for Bobby Kennedy because he had the same idea that John did, and I think John Kennedy sold the country down the road. He gave it to the commies. He literally gave it to the minority. He said, here, you take over. You run the white man. One of these days, it's going too far. In sum, the author concludes, Thane Eugene Caesar hated Bobby Kennedy and almost everything he stood for, and he was virulently opposed to Bobby's positions on the war and civil rights, the two major issues upon which Kennedy had based his campaign for the presidency.
Well, a lot of things to bite on there. I would note not only the obvious tone of Caesar's political views, but note his stated association with American Nazis, because we're going to touch back on that in our broadcasts about the Aryan nations. Okay, so Caesar, an associate of American Nazis, obviously a racist and an ultra right winger, and this fellow, according to he's a security guard standing behind Senator Kennedy, according to the head of the LAPD unit that investigated the crime. No right-wingers are in the pantry, so again, another distortion here. But Thane Eugene Caesar's association with Nazis in light of the Nazi connections to the John Kennedy assassination that we talked about is quite possibly significant, something we're going to touch back on in our next Radio Free America broadcast.
Okay, as we mentioned before, you are, of course, listening to KFJC. This is Radio Free America. I'm Nip Tuck here with Dave Emery. We're going to take a short musical break, give you a chance to get up and stretch and jump up and down a little bit, perhaps. And we know that this is a long time to be sitting in one place, believe me, because we're doing it too. This is from the Radio Free America broadcast that we aired in November of 1984, specifically November 29th, 1984, on the subject of mind control. And as you might guess, one of the main questions that people ask is, well, if Sirhan really was a patsy, you know, I mean, you know, the guy went in there, he waved a gun around, he fired something. I mean, you know, what was the deal? Was he, you know, they couldn't count on having some lunatic coming in off the streets and doing that. Well, this is, of course, one of the things that has to be looked into. And as we will find in this discussion on the upcoming of this segment excerpted from November's Radio Free America, Sirhan proved to be a strangely, easily hypnotizable young man, a real propensity for hypnosis. And we're going to talk about that and some other things on this tape segment.
Okay, now, the very ease with which Sirhan could be hypnotized is one of the main points here, because a hypnotist who hypnotized Sirhan and concluded that Sirhan was a paranoid schizophrenic and an easy subject for hypnosis named Bernard Diamond, who, by the way, is right up the University of California at Berkeley within our signal radius. Diamond basically put his foot in his mouth when he said that, because paranoid schizophrenics are, for all intents and purposes, impossible to hypnotize. So there's a massive internal contradiction in Diamond's statement. Diamond concluded that Sirhan did indeed kill Robert Kennedy, and critics of the official version of the Robert Kennedy assassination have focused on Diamond's role and questioned whether, under hypnosis, Diamond actually convinced Sirhan that he did shoot Robert Kennedy, because Sirhan, as indications will there be indications aplenty in the texts that are going to be on this tape segment, that Sirhan harbored no animosity towards Robert Kennedy and did not want to kill him. So the question about whether or not Sirhan was under mind control and was led to believe that he committed a crime he did not commit is one of the main bones of contention here. Bernard Diamond being one of the focuses of the investigation, one of the points of suspicion, I guess you could say. Another factor is the question of who did hypnoprogram Sirhan originally, because he obviously, we're going to get into the information about his notebooks, but Sirhan produced some interesting notebooks with a lot of interesting writing, and just what that writing said, in what state it was performed, and so forth, is going to be one of the major focuses of this tape segment. And again, mind control is a capability that our intelligence and military have had for many years. We did a three-part Radio Free America series on that. If you'd like to know more about it, and again, I realize that there are some people probably tuned in for the first time or one of the first times and are wondering what we're talking about with mind control, again, our intelligence agencies and our military have had the capability of totally controlling the individual human mind and in small groups for quite some time. Details are available from the Radio Free America shows if you want to call us after the broadcast. But again, as far as the mind control of Sirhan and his possible role as a patsy, a hypnoprogrammed patsy, the discussion that follows is from our Radio Free America show number 6 from November 29th, 1984.
All right. Now, in the early days of the, as a matter of fact, in the very first day of the investigation, the murder of Robert F. Kennedy, there was a particularly interesting discovery made, which was later used as basically being the final nail in the coffin of Sirhan as far as his legal defense went. This, again, is from Operation Mind Control by Walter Bullard, and I'm going to read to you from that. On the floor next to Sirhan's bed was a large spiral notebook. On the desk was another notebook. There was a third small notebook, a good deal of occult literature, a brochure advertising a book on mental projection, and a large brown envelope from the Internal Revenue Service on which someone had written, RFK must be disposed of like his brother was. At the bottom of the envelope was scrawled, reactionary. In one of the notebooks, there was a page which was used later in the trial to prove premeditation. Quote, May 18th, 9:45 a.m., 68. Of course, 1968 was the year in which Kennedy was killed. It was June 5th, so this is supposed to have been about 20 days before the assassination. My determination The notebook reads, to eliminate RFK is becoming more the more of an unshakable obsession. RFK must die. RFK must be killed. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated. RFK must be assassinated. RFK must be assassinated. No punctuation between those. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated before 5 June 68. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated. I have never heard, please pay to the order of this or that. Please pay to the order of. Also drawn on the page were spirals, diamonds, and doodles.
Okay. The next passage here, now we're going to continue a little later in the Operation Mind Control by Walter Boert. We're going to tell you a little bit about someone named the Girl in the Polka Dot Dress and present you with some other anomalies about the Robert Kennedy assassination.
Okay, skipping along in Operation Mind Control. The chief counsel for the Los Angeles chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, A.L. Wirin, spelled W-I-R-I-N, went to Sirhan's defense within hours of his arrest. On his second meeting with the accused, Wirin brought the local papers with him. Sirhan read the headline, Kennedy's dead. Then he dropped his head in grief. After fighting to control his emotions, he looked at Wirin through tearful eyes and said, quote, Mr. Wirin, I'm a failure. I believe in love, and instead of showing love, then Wirin recalled, quote, he muttered something about having betrayed his own primary beliefs. That night, Sirhan complained of being sick. He became very dizzy and had severe stomach cramps, just as Castillo and Candy Jones. By the way, just inserting here, Castillo we already talked about at the end of last show. Candy Jones is coming up. For several weeks, Sirhan was given a half grain of phenobarbital at night to help him sleep. The Los Angeles police went through the motions of looking into the possibility that a conspiracy was behind the RFK assassination. They looked for the girl in the polka dot dress, who witnesses said had been standing next to Sirhan, smiling and talking to him just before he began shooting in the pantry. Sirhan also said he'd been talking to the girl after he'd drunk several Tom Collinses. The girl in the polka dot dress was not found, and conflicting statements cast doubt on whether there had ever been such a girl. 45, quote, top men from the Los Angeles Police Department were assigned the job of tracking down all leads to a conspiracy, but incredibly, they came up empty-handed. A bag of women's clothing, which included a polka dot dress and new undergarments, was found by the LAPD in an alley, but police could not find out who'd brought them or who'd worn them. According to Sirhan's biographer, Robert Blair Kaiser, quote, the police and FBI hardly did all they could to find the owner of the polka dot dress. They used faulty logic and browbeat witnesses to eliminate the girl in the polka dot dress. To penetrate Sirhan's amnesia, the defense decided to call in an expert hypnotist, Dr. Bernard L. Diamond of the University of California. Diamond was the associate dean of UCLA's School of Criminology and a professor of both law and psychiatry. No one knew more about law, psychiatry, and hypnosis than Diamond.
Now, before we tell you more here about Professor Diamond, remember that Sirhan, who supposedly now had assassinated Robert Kennedy, appeared to be very grief-stricken and dumbfounded when informed that Robert Kennedy was dead. He also reacted in a very similar fashion not only to Mr. Castillo, possibly involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, as we looked at in the first broadcast, but also behaved in a fashion very similar to Candy Jones, a CIA mind-control courier who we're going to talk about later in the broadcast. Continuing now with Bernard Diamond, and the section of Walter Boert's book we're going to deal with now basically indicates that in all probability Bernard Diamond had hypnotized Sirhan and under hypnosis convinced Sirhan that he did in fact kill Senator Kennedy, whereas the physical evidence would indicate that he could not have killed Senator Kennedy, and his reaction upon learning of Senator Kennedy's death certainly indicates that he harbored no malice against RFK. Continuing now with Operation Mind Control. In a pre-hypnosis interview, Diamond asked Sirhan to tell him about his notebooks, and Sirhan said he couldn't recall writing them. Now recall, though, those are the same notebooks, the rambling, sort of stuttering notebooks that Nip/Tuck read you about earlier in the book here. Diamond asked if he thought that what he had done helped things, and Sirhan said, quote, I'm not proud of what I did, unquote. What do you mean you're not proud of it, Diamond asked him. You believe in your cause, don't you? Sirhan had been contacted by Arab sympathizers and others who insisted that the reason he'd killed Kennedy was out of sympathy for the PLO. I have no exact knowledge, sir, that this happened yet. It's all in my mind, but goddammit, when my body played with it, I couldn't understand it. I still don't believe it. My body outsmarted my brain, I guess. What did your body do? Diamond asked. Pulled that trigger, Sirhan said. Does your body remember it, even if your mind doesn't? I don't give a damn, sir, in a way. Now I don't even care, Saran said. Diamond asked Saran if he'd thought about suicide. Hell no, Saran said. I couldn't do that. Then Diamond expressed a thought which contained a significant Freudian slip. Why didn't you turn the gas on yourself? Why didn't you turn the gun on yourself after you killed Kennedy? Recall, interrupting here, that many subjects of the CIA and military mind control programs had been trained to commit suicide, as we, discussed in connection with DeMorenshield, as we're going to look at again in connection with Candy Jones, the courier mentioned earlier. Saran waved his hand in front of his face. It was all mixed up, like a dream, unquote. Diamond hypnotized Saran on 6 of 8 visits. At one point, reliving the killing, Saran grabbed at his belt on the left side. Until then, police had no idea where he'd carried the weapon. Under hypnosis, Saran also created writings similar to those in his notebooks. In one session, Diamond had Saran climb the bars of his cell like a monkey. After he'd been brought out of trance, Saran explained the reason for his climb. He said he was only getting exercise. Then Diamond played the tape to prove to Saran that he, Diamond, had given the instructions to Saran to climb the cage, but Saran denied that he'd done it because he'd been hypnotized. At the trial, Dr. Diamond, acting as the director of Saran's defense, testified that Saran was a paranoid schizophrenic. Keep that in mind now. I'll read that last sentence again because this is central to the whole argument here. At the trial, Dr. Diamond, acting as the director of Saran's defense, testified that Saran was a paranoid schizophrenic. His testimony was supported by several other doctors who had examined the psychiatric evidence obtained from tests, interviews, and hypno-interviews conducted by Diamond. Dr. Diamond did not consider that Saran had been other than self-programmed. Having worked for the Army Medical Corps in World War II, he did not realize that the U.S. cryptocracy could develop mind control and use it to control the political destiny of the nation. Saran was given yet another battery of tests by Dr. Eric Marcus, a court-appointed psychiatrist for the defense. Among the tests was the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the MMPI, which contains more than 500 questions requiring true-false answers. Psychologists interpret the answers to the MMPI according to a set of statistical norms. Two of Saran's non-responses were significant, since usually non-responses are considered to be more important than the yes-no responses. The questions Saran did not respond to were, number 291, at one or more times in my life, I felt that someone was making me do things by hypnotizing me. And 293, someone has been trying to influence my mind.
Okay. Continuing on a little further on in Walter Bauert's book, and again, after Sirhan has gone to trial, been convicted, and in the words of Walter Bauert, quickly put away for life, he goes on to talk about some of the experiences that Sirhan had with other hypnotists and hypnosis while in prison. And it says as follows, there were those, however, who refused to let the matter rest. In 1973, while Sirhan sat in prison, Dr. Edward Simpson, the San Quentin prison psychiatrist, submitted an affidavit to the California courts requesting that Saran be granted a new trial and that the Robert Kennedy case be reopened. Dr. Simpson testified that the, quote, expert psychiatric psychological testimony at Sirhan's trial was full of numerous factual errors and misleading to the jury. Quote, most of the doctors testifying, Simpson said, saw their role as proving why Sirhan killed Kennedy, which required a focus on pathology, mental illness, that I found does not exist. They failed to consider the real facts in a more objective light and failed to consider the possibility clearly suggested by the ballistic testimony and Sirhan's own testimony under close scrutiny that perhaps Sirhan did not kill Robert F. Kennedy. Sirhan's trial, Dr. Simpson wrote, was not handled properly by the mental health professionals. In retrospect, a close study of the trial testimony and my own extensive study of Sirhan leads to one irrevocable and obvious conclusion. Sirhan's trial was and will be remembered as the psychiatric blunder of the century. Dr. Simpson knew whereof he spoke. For 6 years, he had worked at San Quentin Prison and had made a study of men on death row. For 2 years, he'd been in charge of the prison psychological testing program. In 1969, he interviewed and tested Sirhan extensively during 20 weekly visits. After these visits were terminated, Sirhan requested that his family contact Simpson for the purpose of reviewing the psychiatric testimony that had been given at his trial. After examining Sirhan and reviewing the, quote, expert psychiatric testimony, Dr. Simpson discussed his findings with the prison's chief psychiatrist, Dr. David G. Schmidt. Together, they concluded that their findings did not confirm, quote, but in fact were strictly in conflict with the findings reported at Sirhan's trial. Quote, nowhere in Sirhan's test response, Dr. Simpson said in the affidavit, was I able to find evidence that he is a, quote, paranoid schizophrenic or, quote, psychotic, as testified by the doctors at the trial. The fact is, paranoid schizophrenics are almost impossible to hypnotize. They are too suspicious and do not trust anybody, including friends and relatives. They do not trust anybody, including friends and relatives, not to speak of a hypnotist from, for him, the most hated race. Psychotics in general are among the poorest subjects for hypnosis. They cannot concentrate, they do not follow instructions, and basically do not trust. Sirhan, however, was an unusually good hypnotic subject. Sirhan asked me to hypnotize him, which I did not do, in order not to contaminate my test findings with fantasies. He himself had manufactured a hypno-disc and was practicing self-hypnosis in his cell, an activity requiring considerable self-control, which no psychotic has. The fact that Sirhan was easy to hypnotize, as testified by Dr. Diamond, proves he was not a paranoid schizophrenic. Quote, Dr. Diamond, Simpson continued, used hypnosis in 6 sessions out of 8 with Sirhan. What was the purpose of it? To plant ideas in Sirhan's mind, ideas that were not there before? To make him accept the idea that he killed Robert F. Kennedy? When Dr. Diamond was unable to get Sirhan to admit that he wrote the notebooks, he testified, quote, so I undertook, this is, by the way, is Simpson talking about Dr. Diamond. He testified, quote, so I undertook some experiments on possible hypnotic suggestion, unquote. This admission, writes Simpson, strongly suggests the possibility of hypnosis being used for implanting hypothetical ideas in Sirhan's mind rather than uncovering facts. A lie detector, not hypnosis, should have been used in finding out whether Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy. Now, before we continue on, let me just point out one factor here besides the obvious things being stated here, and that is Sirhan's own increasing interest in hypnotism. As we're going to see later in the broadcast when we get to talking about James Earl Ray and some other people, it's possible that this interest in hypnotism could be in and of itself evidence perhaps of a lingering feeling, an undefinable feeling on the part of a hypnoprogrammed subject that something is wrong and that some kind of hypnosis is necessary to figure out what has been done. So again, this is just a possibility, but it does seem to crop up in other similar cases.
Going back to Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert. Sirhan, Dr. Diamond concluded, had obviously had experience with hypnosis before. He found that Sirhan was reluctant to speak under hypnosis, but that he could easily write without being post-hypnotically blocked. Writing under hypnosis is called automatic writing, Diamond said, and the term aptly describes the way Sirhan would write like a robot and keep on repeating a word or phrase until I stopped him, unquote. Taking a sheet off a legal pad lying nearby, Diamond asked Sirhan to write his answers to the questions put to him in the hypnotic trance. He showed Sirhan a sample of his diary page. Is this crazy writing? Diamond asked. Yes, 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 Sirhan wrote. Are you crazy? Diamond asked. No, no, Sirhan wrote. Well, why are you writing crazy? Diamond asked. Practice, 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 Sirhan responded. Practice for what? Diamond asked. Mind control, mind control, mind control, is what Sirhan wrote. Now remember, Diamond hypnotizes Sirhan, testifies that he's a paranoid schizophrenic, and yet provides contradictory testimony that he was easy to hypnotize. Paranoid schizophrenics are, for all intents and purposes, as in Dr. Simpson's testimony read earlier, impossible to hypnotize. So it appears that Dr. Diamond's analysis of Sirhan's situation is not only contradictory, but strongly suggests that, as indicated in Bowert's text, that Dr. Diamond was actually planting the idea in Sirhan's head that he had killed Robert Kennedy. It's worth noting that a lie detector is considered much, much more reliable than hypnosis, which frequently pollutes the results in a criminal investigation, and yet Diamond said he had no faith in a lie detector, but had a lot of faith in hypnosis. And while lie detectors are fallible, they're considered much, much more reliable than hypnosis. But again, remember that Diamond actually contradicted himself. Not only is there no evidence that Sirhan was a paranoid schizophrenic, but that Diamond's testimony that he was easy to hypnotize basically confirms that.
Okay, now, before Dave reads the next segment, I want to mention to you that this is out of a book that, if you are interested in the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, and obviously we don't have much time to talk about it tonight, although we are touching on it quite a bit because of the aspect of mind control, this is quite a good book, and as far as I know, it's available in a lot of libraries. You might want to go out and check out a copy if you'd like to. It's a very affecting and moving book, and very interesting because it's written from by people who are actually involved in trying to track this stuff down, as opposed to somebody sitting back as a spectator. The book is The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, and it's by John Christian, J-O-N-N, Christian, and William G. Turner.
And it's Bill Turner, by the way, is a former FBI agent, and it's published in hardcover by Random House, copyrighted 1978. Now, one of the interesting things that Christian and Turner present here is the fact that Saran Saran, that he, as indicated in Bowert's text, was very, very easy to hypnotize and had probably been hypnotized before. Now, one of the things that came out in the course of the investigation, although it did not receive a great deal of emphasis by a special unit senator for reasons you may be able to divine at this point, was the fact that Saran Saran had been associated with a fellow by the name of Manly Palmer Hall. Now, Manly Palmer Hall was a master hypnotist. Interestingly enough, Manly Palmer Hall also served as not only a hypnotist, but a sort of a guru to Los Angeles Mayor Sam Yorty. Yorty was mayor of Los Angeles when Senator Kennedy was killed there in 1968. And it's worth noting, too, that Sam Yorty was one of the people who emerged the morning after the assassination, tossing red herrings all about him by suggesting that Saran was a communist and had many communist leanings, and then Yorty made a flaming rectum out of himself by referring to the Rosicrucians as a communist organization. But it's interesting that the same, or one of the same hypnotists that Saran was associated with, was also very, very close to Sam Yorty, a reactionary, a man tied to Patrick Frawley, a right-wing luminary, very close to Ronald Reagan, among others. And interesting that Saran and Yorty, who was so instrumental in presenting the, in pointing the finger at Saran as a communist early on in the investigation, much as Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged leftist, was bruited about as an agent of Marxism. Again, both of them, both Saran and Yorty, connected to Manly Palmer Hall. Reading from The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Conveniently omitted was the fact that a police search of Saran's car yielded a volume entitled Healing, the Divine Art by Manly Palmer Hall, founder of the Philosophical Research Society. The book mysteriously disappeared from the grand jury exhibits. Hall, a man with penetrating eyes, chiseled features, and a Buddha-like figure, was a master hypnotist with a practice in hypnotherapy. Some time ago, he had gained considerable publicity from hypnotic antics, on one occasion putting under, unquote, a movie actor and convincing him he was suffocating, with the result that the actor tore apart a movie set in his frantic search for air. We queried Saran in San Quentin about Hall and his society. He wrote back that he remembered paying several visits to the headquarters, an alabaster temple near Griffith Park. The secretary there had a distinct foreign accent, unquote, he said. Hall's wife is German-born. And I had to ask her to unlock the bookcases for me to get the books I wanted to read in the library. I remember seeing Manly Hall himself there. Saran's dabbling with the occult society is, by itself, innocuous, but there is a certain irony in the fact that he was drinking from the same mystical fountain as Sam Yorty. For some two decades, the mayor had been a student of Hall, whom he regarded as his guru. Now, in the next section of Robert F. Kennedy, The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by Turner and Christian, there is some discussion here of a fellow named William Joseph Bryan, Jr. Now, William Joseph Bryan, Jr., according to some speculation engaged in by Turner and Christian, may have been the person who hypnoprogrammed Saran in the first place to be in the lobby, the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel. Worth noting maybe in passing, too, that the Ambassador Hotel was owned by G. David Shine, who was one of Joseph McCarthy's assistants in the anti-communist witch hunt of the early 1950s. But this William Joseph Bryan, Jr. is a subject of some lengthy discussion in The Assassination of Robert Kennedy.
All right, continuing on with the text. Our quest for Sirhan's programmer had been no more successful than the search for Amelia Earhart, until Dr. Herbert Spiegel gave us a lead. Anything mentioned in the presence of a subject under hypnosis is automatically etched into his mind, especially if it comes from the hypnotist, and it might flow out at any time. This brought us back to the notebooks containing Sirhan's, quote, automatic writing. Could he have scrawled something during a trance regression that the hypnotist had mentioned while programming him? There was a passage that stood out because it was, unlike the others, having nothing to do with horses, politics, money, or past acquaintances. It read, quote, God help me, please help me, salvo D, spelled D-I-D, salvo, die, S-salvo. The reference apparently was to Albert DeSalvo, the notorious Boston Strangler. That case had been cracked by the use of hypnotism, and the hypnotist was Dr. William Joseph Bryan, Jr. of Los Angeles. Bryan billed himself as, quote, probably the leading expert in the world on the use of hypnosis in criminal law, and often boasted about being called into baffling cases by law enforcement agencies, including the LAPD. The Boston Strangler case was his tour de force, and he was incessantly mentioning it. An imposing man with a wrestler's girth, Bryan claimed he was once drummer with a Tommy Dorsey band and a commercial airplane pilot. During the Korean War, he had put his hypnotic skills to use as, in his words, quote, chief of all medical survival training for the United States Air Force, which meant the brainwashing section, unquote. After the war, he reportedly became a CIA consultant in the agency's experimentation with mind control and behavior modification. Refused membership in all traditional medical societies, Bryan set up a medical and hypnotherapy practice on the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, which he named the American Institute of Hypnosis. He used it as an aegis for wide-ranging symposiums on such topics as, quote, successful treatments of sexual disorders. Quote, I enjoy variety and I like to get to know people on a deep emotional level, he once told a magazine interviewer. One way of getting to know people is through intercourse. In 1969, the California Board of Medical Examiners found him guilty of unprofessional conduct for sexually molesting four women patients who submitted under hypnosis. Despite his advocacy of sexual freedom, Bryan was a Bible-quoting fundamentalist who belonged to a fire and brimstone sect called the Old Roman Catholic Church, which broke away from the Vatican over a century ago. Skipping down to the footnotes is, curiously, David W. Ferry, a prime suspect in New Orleans D.A. Jim Garrison's 1967 probe into the John Kennedy assassination, also belonged to this small sect. Ferry was found dead on February 22, 1967, shortly after being interrogated. Should mention that Ferry himself was also a pilot, as was apparently Bryan, or at least as Bryan claimed to be. Anyway, so Bryan was a member of the Old Roman Catholic Church. Bryan claimed to be a descendant of the fiery orator William Jennings Bryan, who opposed the teaching of evolution and celebrated Scopes' monkey trial. And he frequently was a guest preacher at fundamentalist churches in Southern California. Only hours after the Robert F. Kennedy shooting, and before Sirhan had been identified, Bryan appeared on the Los Angeles radio program of Ray Bream on KABC, and offhandedly commented that the suspect probably acted under post-hypnotic suggestion. 2 years later, when Bryan appeared on another local radio program, Christian, that's John Christian, the author, one of the authors, Christian called in and asked him about his prescient analysis on the Bream show. At first, Bryan hedged, then declared that he had no professional opinion because he had not personally examined Sirhan. He quickly switched the subject to the Hollywood Strangler case, in which a Henry Bush was executed for murder. Quote, he utilized self-hypnosis, Bryan asserted, noting that Bush once tried to burn off his own arm with cigarettes under self-hypnosis. Quote, to get rid of the offending part, just like the old thing in the Bible, you know, if the left hand offend thee, cut it off. When we, meaning the authors again, asked Sirhan about the DeSalvo entry in his notebook, he replied that the name was entirely foreign to him. Was it possible that Bryan had placed Sirhan in a trance state and, given his propensity to boast constantly about the Boston Strangler case, repeated DeSalvo's name over and over, thus etching it into Sirhan's subconscious? In any case, Sirhan would not remember either the circumstances of his exposure to the name or who mentioned it. Since Bryan's ego seemed boundless, it was possible that an interview with him would produce the unexpected. It did. On June 18, 1974, Betsy Langman, a disarmingly attractive New York writer with whom we had been comparing notes, talked to Bryan in his Sunset Strip office suite on the pretext of doing a general article on hypnosis. The doctor went on at length about his standing in the field of hypnosis, quote, I am probably the leading expert in the world, and abilities, quote, I can hypnotize everybody in this office in less than 5 minutes, detailed his successes with Henry Bush and Albert DeSalvo, and ventured opinions on various aspects of hypnosis. But when Langman, who had been researching the possibility of assassination through mind control, asked, quote, do you feel that Sirhan could have been self-hypnotized? His expansiveness vanished. I'm not going to comment on that case, Ryan said curtly, because I didn't hypnotize him. When Langman explained that she simply wanted his opinion, Ryan exploded. You are going around trying to find some more ammunition to put out that same old crap, he said, that people can be hypnotized into doing all these weird things. He charged out of his office, snapping, This interview is over.
Another interesting thing is presented in the next section of the Turner and Christian discussion of Brian, and we'll sum up some of the key points of this afterward. Shaken by the angry outburst, Langman went across the street for coffee, accompanied by a sympathetic secretary. Langman was...